Good mornings, I'm Chris Oakes, and coming up today, this year marks the 50th anniversary of the Honda Accord, the car that certainly altered the trajectory of Ohio's economy and in many respects led to the transformation of the entire auto industry. Also this morning on another Mental Health Monday, remembering Grandpa Tony. The substance abuse recovery community has lost a friend and dedicated advocate with the passing of Tony Grotrin earlier this month. And the Hancock County OSU Extension is highlighting summer food safety, especially with Ohio being one of the top states at the center of the recent cyclosporiasis outbreak. This is the Good Mornings Podcast Edition for Monday, July 13th, 2026. So this is really cool. I don't know if you happen to hear about this. I actually saw this on the Newswire on Friday and didn't get the chance to mention it on Friday, but I'll bring it up this morning. Construction is now underway on what is the last commercial high-rise building at the rebuilt World Trade Center site. Nearly 25 years after the 9/11 terror attacks, a groundbreaking ceremony took place last week for two World Trade Center in Lower Manhattan. American Express is making the 55-story building its global headquarters when it opens in 2031, complete with 10,000 workers. Side 55 stories be done in 2031, so the 30th anniversary of 9/11. But that's ground broken to World Trade Center. Final building in the reconstruction of the World Trade Center site. That's pretty cool. Let's see. A couple of other items here. Among the first things that you need to know this morning, the most interesting and buzzworthy stories of the day. New state law in effect now, aimed at protecting first responders on the job. And this made headlines when this bill was introduced, and it's passed, it's been signed, and it is now the law. House Bill 20 establishes a buffer zone for emergency workers in Ohio. The law makes it illegal to get within 15 feet of a police officer, firefighter, or medical responder who is performing official duties. If you have been given a verbal warning, you have to step back 15 feet. And the penalty for obstructing a first responder has been increased. It's always been illegal to obstruct a first responder, but this establishes that specific buffer zone and increases the penalty from a second-degree misdemeanor to a first-degree misdemeanor under this legislation. House Bill 20, and it is now in effect, or it is, it is in effect. So you see somebody doing their job, a first responder, police officer, firefighter, EMT, give them room. It is the law. Ohio is once again at the top of a list, or very close to the top of a list, that you really do not want to be at the top of. Ohio is among the worst states in the nation when it comes to bed bug infestations. Learned that over the weekend. Yeah, I saw this. According to Orkin Pest Control, in rankings based on metro areas where the most commercial and residential bed bug treatments were performed over the past year, Chicago is number one with the highest infestation rate. Then comes Los Angeles, Detroit, Cleveland, and Indianapolis. Those are the top five. But Ohio is the most represented state on this year's list. Six cities in the top 50. So you've got Cleveland at number four, Columbus at number eight, Cincinnati at 15, Youngstown was 32nd, Dayton 38th, and Toledo number 42. Six cities in the top 50. Oddly enough, I thought this was kind of interesting. Even Las Vegas. This is the city with more hotel rooms than anywhere in the world in Las Vegas. And even Vegas was 43rd below Toledo, one place below Toledo. So all six of the Ohio cities, not only in the top 50, all of them, more bed bug infestations than even Las Vegas, which I found to be crazy. So we are at the top of not the list that you want to be at the top of. And yet here we are. Some of the most interesting and buzzworthy stories to get your Monday morning started. A couple of other items here that I thought were interesting, too. Have you ever gone to a restaurant, can't decide what to order, so you ask your server for a recommendation? Happened to us over the weekend. Happened to me over the weekend. Went to a restaurant that we'd not been to before. And so I'm looking over the menu. Everything looks good. So I have no idea what to order. So I asked the server, what's your favorite? What do you recommend? This is the advice. And this is, I guess, from experts in the culinary world. Do not ask your server. Asking your server for a recommendation is fine. But do not ask, what's your favorite? That may not give you the best meal on the menu. Restaurant professionals say diners should instead ask, what are you known for? You go to a restaurant you've not been to before, ask them, what are you known for? Because every really good restaurant is known for something. So what are you known for? Or you can ask, what's your specialty? Stephanie Mell, owner of Alabama-based Church Street Family Restaurant and Hospitality Group, says those questions start a conversation and help the wait staff tailor recommendations for each customer. Robert Mahon, owner of Mahon Hospitality in New York and Dublin, says servers know which dishes guests consistently love and what's being executed well that day. And that can vary from one day to the next because you have a whole kitchen staff. Not everybody in the kitchen works the same time on the same day. So, as some chefs will prepare some dishes better than others, that's a good thing to and the wait staff would know that. So they know what is being well executed that day. He says the most common mistake that diners make is ordering what they're familiar with instead of trying the dishes the restaurant is actually known for. So whether that's going to a favorite restaurant and just ordering the same thing off the menu time and time again, and I have to admit I'm guilty of that, or going to a new restaurant for the first time and just ordering something that you think you will be comfortable with based on the fact that you've ordered it off of the menu at other places. You know what I mean? And you can go anywhere and order a burger, but even a gourmet burger, but if you go to a restaurant, that may or may not be the best thing on the menu. Talk with your server. But be careful the way you phrase the question is basically the long and short of it there. Thought that was kind of interesting. Something to keep in mind next time you go to a new restaurant. And speaking of food, here's something to think about as you are getting up this morning, maybe heading off for your morning workout. A lot of people do that, get up early and work out first thing in the morning. If you want that workout, that exercise to be particularly effective, a new study suggests that smelling chocolate before exercising could significantly improve your athletic performance. Smelling chocolate. Not eating chocolate, not smelling like chocolate. You don't want to roll around in, chocolate sauce or something. No, just smelling chocolate. Researchers found that participants who sniffed dark chocolate, in particular, before a workout, completed up to 18 more reps compared to those who didn't. Scientists caution that the findings are preliminary. More research is needed before drawing any conclusions, but that did not stop them from drawing conclusions. They believe that the scent triggers a psychological response that increases motivation and reduces perceived exertion, allowing people to push themselves harder during an exercise session. The effect is linked to various compounds in dark chocolate that may stimulate the brain when inhaled. Don't worry if somebody is looking at you funny because you're sniffing a chocolate bar. It can help you maximize your workout. So there you go. Some of the most interesting and buzzworthy stories to get your Monday morning started.
WFIN News, I'm Matt Demchek. Your WTOL 11 weather. Plenty of sunshine expected today with a high in the 80s. Mostly clear tonight, low in the 60s. There's a new law in Ohio that drivers and their passengers need to be aware of in case they get pulled over.
Governor Mike DeWine just signed a new law mandating that drivers and passengers give their names, addresses, and birth date during a traffic stop. Say no, you're looking at up to 30 days in jail and a $250 fine. Police say it's a safety measure, but critics, such as the Public Defender's Office, says it's overkill, even for something as minor as a broken taillight.
ONN's Christy Paul reporting. Get more on the new law in this story on our website. The Findlay Police Department is requesting the public's help in identifying an individual believed to be responsible for the assault of an elderly person. Police say the assault happened in the parking lot of 2320 Tiffin Avenue, and the suspect had been riding a skateboard in the parking lot prior to the altercation. You can see some surveillance pictures of the suspect and get the number to call with information and tips in this story on our website. Officials say Hancock County's new microtransit system will be a reality in early 2027 because businesses, local government, nonprofits, and philanthropy came together around a shared vision. The Community Action Commission says they're grateful to the many businesses, community partners, and nonprofit organizations whose ongoing support helps make affordable, accessible, and reliable public transportation possible for the community every day. They say together they're building a stronger, more connected Hancock County. Get more details in this story on our website. The city of Findlay is inviting people to play ball with the mayor, followed by Fun for All with the Flag City Sluggers. On Tuesday at 4:30 at Miracle Field, youth are invited to join Mayor Mearn for a softball game with Sluggers players. And then at 6:05 p.m., admission to the Flag City Sluggers game will be free to all Hancock County residents as part of the Community Foundation's Fun for All series of free community events. Get more details in this story on our website. Remember, you can always get more news anytime at WFIN.com.
Honda Accord. We've tested the Accord under grueling road conditions here at testing grounds in Ohio. Because life isn't always a simple Sunday drive.
Honda, we make it simple.
Well, America 250 isn't the only historical milestone that we celebrate this summer. It is also the 50th anniversary of the Honda Accord, a car that changed what Americans expected from a car, certainly altered the trajectory of the Ohio economy, and led to the transformation of the entire auto industry in many respects. Joining us this morning is the Executive Vice President in charge of manufacturing for Honda of America, June J. Rahman. And June, the Accord was really a stroke of genius. I mean, when it was introduced, still very economical to drive, a little larger, though, than the Civic. It really made a strong appeal to American drivers. Where does the development of the Accord kind of rank in your mind, sort of in the history of automobile evolution and innovation?
Well, it's got to be up there towards the top. So I've been with Honda for 37 years, and I've watched the evolution of this vehicle. When I started in 1989, it was a very basic passenger vehicle, and it's changed over the years so much. And it's an elevated, well-appointed vehicle now. It checks all the boxes. And just a story recently that happened to me. I was in Columbus in an Uber, and the driver was driving an Accord hybrid. And I always like to ask drivers if they have Hondas. I don't tell them where I'm from, but I asked them about it. I said, how do you like your Accord hybrid? He said, it's probably the best car he's ever owned. And it was getting close to 50 miles per gallon, which was amazing to me because I don't own an Accord right now, and I didn't realize how good our hybrid, especially the Accord hybrid, is. So it continues to amaze me as a vehicle.
As groundbreaking as this vehicle was, it really was the beginning of U.S. manufacturing in 1982 that was a game changer. How did that decision to build the Accord in the U.S. and, of course, ultimately in Ohio, kind of changed the trajectory of the Honda Motor Company?
Yeah, we were the first foreign automaker to successfully build in the U.S. I think Volkswagen started in Pennsylvania a little bit before us, but they didn't last very long. So we were the first foreign automaker to actually build cars where we were selling them. And for many years, the Accord was the foundational car for us at the Marysville Auto Plant. As I mentioned, I've been there for many, many years, and there were many years where we just couldn't build enough Accords.
Yeah.
You know, it was a top seller in the U.S. for many, many years, and, you know, the market has shifted a bit, but the Accord is still a very solid performer for us overall.
And it did not just change the game for Honda. It was a major boost, of course, for the state of Ohio. Again, you think back to 1982 and, you know, what was happening with the economy and sort of the Rust Belt was forming in the American Midwest. And what is the impact of Honda and its affiliated partners? Because it's not just Honda directly. It's so many partners. What is the impact to the Ohio economy today?
Yeah, you know, you're absolutely right, Chris. We've been manufacturing not just cars, but we started out with motorcycles in 1979.
Right.
Then we moved into auto in 1982. So we're coming up on our 50th year of manufacturing in Ohio. So right now, Honda has more than 12,000 associates working in manufacturing, and then probably another 2,000 in R&D. And, you know, it's more than the current workforce. We have generations of Honda associates raising families, growing in the communities. And as an example, not that long ago, a friend of mine who had since retired, I saw a young lady on the assembly line, and she looked super familiar. And then I realized that her picture as a young girl was on my colleague's desk. And I walked over to her and I said, "Hey, are you Dana's daughter?" And she said, "Yeah, how did you know?" I said, "Well, I saw your picture on his desk for the last 15 years." So it's a generational thing here in Ohio.
I think I read that of the 15 million Accords sold since its introduction, 13 million of those have been built in Ohio. And so that's just a mind-boggling number.
Yeah, absolutely. There were some years there because we couldn't keep up with the demand. Japan was also building a portion of those as well. We've also built them in Alabama and a couple other factories as well, because we just couldn't keep up with the Accord demand overall.
Yeah. And zooming out even further, the introduction of the American-made Honda Accord really forever altered, I think, the entire automobile industry in many respects. I mean, as you were mentioning, the first foreign car to be built with great success in the U.S. And now every nameplate really is building cars all over the world. Talk about how different the auto manufacturing industry is today compared to 1982.
Yeah, it's definitely a different world right now. And then recently it's been more complex with the regulations, tariffs and that nature. It's getting more and more complex, more and more difficult. But we've been solid in our commitment to building cars in the United States, or building cars where the customers are at. That's one of the key foundational pieces of Honda philosophy overall. And we've kind of stuck to those basics over the years.
And it all started with the first Honda Accord 50 years ago this summer. For those who don't know, how many manufacturing facilities does Honda have in Ohio today? I mean, when most people think of Honda of America, they think of Marysville. But beyond that, how many facilities do you have? How many models today are actually built here? Because this is a lot more than just the Accord now.
Absolutely. We have five manufacturing plants in Ohio: Marysville, East Liberty, which both build completed cars. We have the Performance Manufacturing Center, which builds some specialty vehicles, the Anna Engine Plant in Anna, Ohio, and the Honda Transmission Plant in Russell's Point, Ohio. And then, in addition, we have some R&D facilities in and around Marysville as well. As far as models we build Honda and Acuras. We build the Accord, Accord Hybrid, CR-V, CR-V Hybrid, the Integra, the RDX, and the MDX. Those are the CBUs. Wow. We call them complete bodies that we build in Ohio.
Yeah. And yet, the Accord is still kind of the bread and butter model for Honda in Ohio. Again, 50 years, there are not a whole lot of models that go 50 years. I can think of a few, but not too many. What do you believe gives this particular car such staying power?
Well, just if I could be honest about one thing, I feel like the bread and butter and the preferences of the customers are shifting, and we're watching that. The CR-V is becoming our bread and butter, but I know this story is about the Accord.
Right.
And the Accord is one of the most awarded vehicles in our history, Car and Driver, in their 10 best awards. Accord's been named to that magazine 10 best list a record 40 times.
Wow.
And I think that's matched by any other automobile.
And I have to ask, because especially over the past few years, we've seen even more change and tremendous innovation in the industry. What does the future hold? I mean, we're talking about for the Honda Accord and for Honda of America in general.
Yeah, our focus, and again, going back to Honda philosophy, it's always been focusing on what the customer's needs are. What does the customer want? Customer preferences are shifting towards hybrids. I think that's not new information. And recently, our global CEO, Mibe San, he made an announcement and talked about how we're going to be expanding our hybrid lineup. And to fulfill that promise, Honda in Ohio needs to continue to build and invest. So we're going to see some investments, especially on the engine and powertrain side, that are tied to that that promise of introducing new hybrid models.
Almost 50 years in Ohio and still growing strong. Again, the 50th anniversary of the Honda Accord. It's pretty cool that back when Americans were getting ready to celebrate the bicentennial in 1976, here comes this brand new vehicle. And now we're celebrating the semi-quincentennial in 2026 and still talking about this vehicle and what a tremendous impact it's had on Ohio and on the industry. Again, June J. Rahman is Executive Vice President in charge of manufacturing for Honda of America. June, thanks very much for taking some time and kind of strolling down memory lane here with us. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Chris. Appreciate your time this morning.
I want to take a few moments on another Mental Health Monday this morning to remember Grandpa Tony. The substance abuse recovery community's lost friend and dedicated advocate with the passing of Tony Grotrin locally earlier this month. And Zach Thomas is with us, director of Hancock County Alcohol, Drug Abuse, and Mental Health Services. And what can you say about the legacy that Tony Grotrin kind of leaves for the community? It's just an amazing story of how he became involved in the battle against opioid addiction and use.
Yeah. You know, Chris, I think one of the things that we can think about Tony's legacy is that he took something that was a very tragic experience, the loss of his grandson, and turned it into some of the most amazing advocacy for people struggling with addiction, not only locally but across the state.
Yeah,
and I would say he probably had some national impact too if people learned about Hancock County, but he was a quiet warrior that would come in, attend all of our meetings, always have something poignant to say, and always kept us on our toes, making sure that we were staying with what we wanted to accomplish and try to achieve in the community.
When you obviously over the years you had many interactions with Tony, what was your, when you first met him and yeah, you know, again, when he was very early on in this crusade of his, and I don't say that in a bad way, certainly, what were your initial thoughts the first time you met him?
Well, it was interesting because the first time I experienced or learned of Tony was right after his grandson passed away. And I actually was a member of the Adamus board at the time. Mm-hmm. And there was this gentleman that was sitting in the back of the room that was seething with anger, and he was incredibly upset.
Yeah.
And upset with what was not available, or, you know, what were we going to do because of what happened? And, you know, you kind of sat there, and I had never necessarily experienced someone being that angry that close to me before. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that grief was turned into action. And so when then I started to work here at the board, and helping to guide the coalition, you know, he was there. He took that grief and put it into action to try to really make some change.
That is I think the most amazing part of the story, because, you know, as we all know, people deal with grief in all kinds of different ways. And in his case, he channeled that into action, but his thought process in that sort of evolved over time. I know initially, you know, he was a strong advocate, as many people in the community were at the time, for strong enforcement of drug laws and let's lock them up and let's, you know, but that evolved over time as the community's kind of thoughts on the addiction crisis evolved over time. And that's probably not a coincidence.
No, and I would say you could see the evolution, particularly as we continue to bring in the science about addiction and understanding that, you know, addiction is a disorder of the brain and disease of the brain. And he would be the first to correct anyone in the room that would say it was because of, you know, moral failings. He would say, no, there is a physical thing that happens in the brain that causes addiction. And so he really changed his thinking with that. And I think, you know, even more so, Chris, was when, you know, it led him to lead to the 911 Good Samaritan law, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, showing that empathy for people that are in the throes of addiction who still need dignity and humanity given to them, even though that they may be participating in illegal activity. And so that evolution of his thinking and his impact has been really profound.
How valuable was that over the years in terms of getting that message out to the community and even to lawmakers? Because he came at this from a story of having personally been touched by it. And it's one thing to have clinicians and experts such as yourself to speak to these issues, but when it's somebody who has experienced that firsthand, it becomes such a more powerful message for the average person to hear.
Yeah, I agree. And I think also what was unique to Tony was he tried to educate, he did educate himself as much as possible. He went to every conference that the state had, either locally or, you know, in Columbus, to learn about recovery and to learn about addiction. And I think because he was very skillful and to be able to you know, braid together his grief and his personal story with what he is learning behind science and addiction and what is good recovery, I think that was what made his impact more powerful, because you could have facts and figures along with story to really change. And I think that is what made such an impact on legislators to agree to move forward that piece of legislation.
Probably to a greater extent, again, than just hearing from individuals such as yourself. When you can have that personal story attached to it, and you can see, I mean, he obviously turned a family tragedy into something incredibly positive, but clearly never got over, you know, the loss of his grandson. That's something that you just don't get over. And that, you know, still came out in all of the advocacy, all of the talks that he would speak to anybody about his passion for this. And that's something that you always felt.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, is wanting to also help others not experience the same thing. Mm-hmm. Particularly, I know you read in the paper about Judge Niemeyer and even Judge Routson have both said that, you know, he was always at every hearing for drug court.
Yeah.
And would always meet with the defendants at the end of the session to try to say, hey, you know what, you matter and you're important.
And was a huge advocate for the establishment of the drug court. I mean, there's another thing that maybe that doesn't happen without his steadfast advocacy for that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he was a stalwart there. He was always visible and always advocating for the importance of that. And I think the fact that we had someone that had that experience as Tony to speak along with folks like at our office, like with Presha, as she was moving forward, trying to help get drug court established along with the judges, I think that made it that much more impactful to make sure that we got that implemented here in the community.
And again, bridging that connection with the community, because here the community can see just an average person like themselves that, you know, is convinced of its value and convinced of the value of those who are touched by addiction and, you know, putting that personal spin on it. So what happens next? I mean, you know, obviously you've lost a huge advocate and a valuable asset in the fight. So how do you go forward and continue that legacy now that he's gone?
You know, Tony's impact on so many people that are still engaged with the coalition and with our board and in the community at large, I think we're going to see him continuously, you know, not physically, but his message and what he tried to accomplish and did accomplish, and people will be inspired by that. And I think that is any legacy that anyone could hope for, and that he's made that impact.
Again, Zach Thomas is Executive Director of Hancock County Alcohol, Drug Abuse, and Mental Health Services, ADAMUS, locally remembering Grandpa Tony, Tony Gortran, who passed away earlier this month at the age of 88 after many years of staunch advocacy for the substance abuse recovery community locally. Hard to replace somebody like that, but what a tremendous legacy he leaves. Thanks very much for being with us this morning, Zach. We appreciate your
thoughts. Thank you for sharing your memory. Thank you.
This is Good Mornings with Chris Oakes on 1330 WFIN, WFIN.com, and 95.5 FM.
It is International Day, and the broken news this morning, a British Airways flight carrying 336 passengers had to be canceled after multiple cabin crew members were allegedly too intoxicated to work following a night of heavy drinking. They weren't just hungover, they were wasted. The incident involved staff at a high-end resort the night before last Sunday's flight from Barbados to London. One flight attendant reportedly vomited at the bar, while another collapsed and had to be carried to his room. Eurocontrol data indicates the cancellation of the flight cost the airline over $133,000 in hotels and transport for stranded passengers. Four employees have since been suspended, and British Airways said it is urgently investigating. Now, be careful who you send to Barbados there. I mean, it's a place that kind of lends itself to big celebrations, but not if you're supposed to be working the next day. Speaking of flying, this is a crazy story. Just so bizarre. A flight instructor in Argentina jumped to his death during a flight lesson this past week. Not this past weekend, but last weekend, leaving his student to land the aircraft alone. Flight instructor Leandro Andres Bertazzo, age 42, told his 22-year-old student during the flight, "You know what you have to do, so carry on." At which point he removed his headset, unbuckled his seatbelt, and jumped out of the plane. It was a Cessna 150. Now that's a bizarre test right there. The student, identified only as Rosario, fortunately safely landed the plane despite being in complete shock. Wow! That is, I guess the upside is that if you're that student, you probably feel like you were prepared for just about anything at that point. But how bizarre. Absolutely crazy is that story. And finally, in the broken news this morning, a 49-year-old Japanese woman has been arrested after allegedly sewing her housemate's lips together with a needle and thread. Apparently got tired of her rattling on and on and on. So I'll fix this. Masai Sukare was taken into custody last Monday near Tokyo. The 42-year-old victim had her lips pierced below the nose and upper lip with thread passing through the inside of her mouth. She told police she had to escape to a nearby shop and get help using a written note. Because her lips were sewn together. She had to use a written note. The victim said Ms. Sukari had become angry over something. Well, I would hope so. I would hope that there was, that she didn't just do this randomly. That she had been angry over something. Her response to the allegations has not been disclosed. Police are investigating. I mean, honestly, though, if you've ever had a roommate, haven't you at some point wanted to do that? Haven't you at some point wished that you could probably do that? But this woman actually did it, and yeah, you're not allowed to do that. There you go. That is today's broken news report, an update on the odd and unusual side of the headlines. We now return you to your regularly scheduled programming.
Take WFIN wherever you go with our updated mobile app for iPhone and Android. And now you can listen to us on your Alexa device. Get the app at WFIN.com or in the App Store or Google Play. Plus, enable Alexa by searching for WFIN under Skills, and you'll soon be saying, Alexa, play 1330 WFIN. And the best part is the apps and skills are absolutely free. On the air at 1330 WFIN and 95.5 FM. Online at WFIN.com and on your smartphone, tablet, and Alexa devices.
I'm now for your daily download. The numbers behind the news and the statistics that shape our lives. Who do your kids view as a hero? Who's the biggest hero in the minds of your kids? A new survey of parents and children between the ages of 4 and 12 finds that real-life figures outrank fictional heroes in the eyes of our kids. Parents lead as the top heroes. Parents. Yes, that's right, Mom and Dad. Maybe you don't feel like it sometimes. Maybe it doesn't seem like it sometimes. But parents lead as the top heroes, the top role models at 71%. 71% of kids cite their parents. That's followed by teachers at 40%. So that's pretty good runner-up, but far behind parents. And you think about that. And actually, their siblings at 37%, which I thought was kind of interesting, in that fictional superheroes rank all the way down at 29%, while celebrities are even seen as less of heroes at 22%. So if you've ever thought that maybe we place too much emphasis on celebrity and put our celebrities up on a pedestal. No, apparently our kids are smarter than that. They're able to discern that. Kids say they value bravery, strength, and kindness over superficial traits. And this I thought was kind of interesting. 74% of parents say that their definition of what makes a hero has evolved over time. 57% display heroic qualities by teaching their kid to express themselves in healthy ways. 55% by allowing their children to explore their own interests. And 52% of parents cite practicing patience in stressful situations. Which is not always easy. Even for parents, even for hero parents, it's not always easy. But that is a big part of it. And this will certainly leave you with a smile on your face and a warm heart. 82% of kids in the survey, 82% of kids say that they want to be considered a hero themselves someday. Time for our regular update. Find out what's happening at the Hancock County OSU Extension. This month, we are kind of highlighting summer food safety, especially with Ohio being one of the top states at the center of the recent cyclosporiasis outbreak. And Jennifer Little is with us, family and consumer sciences educator, the Hancock County OSU Extension. First of all, let's start with the basics here, because I've been hearing about this, but not really following it incredibly closely. What is cyclosporiasis? That's a tough word.
Yes, it is. It is. I kept thinking psoriasis, you know, it sounds like that. Cyclosporiasis is a foodborne illness. And it's been on the rise in Northwest Ohio and Southeast Michigan. It is a gastrointestinal infection caused by a parasite, Cyclospora. And it generally affects the small intestine, and it causes explosive diarrhea, not in the at the risk of sounding a little graphic, watery, and it comes on pretty suddenly. Symptoms can show up, and it's caused by consuming something that has the Cyclospora parasite in it.
So
generally,
fresh produce
that has not been cleaned properly. So safe food handling is kind of the way to avoid this.
Yeah.
In Ohio right now, there's been 177 known cases. Only one in Hancock County as of last week, according to the health department.
Mm-hmm.
But Wood and Lucas County have had greater impact. Lucas had 30 cases as of the end of last week, and Wood County had 20 cases. There's been no deaths here in the state of Ohio. Again, mm-hmm. if it is an infection that can be treated with antibiotics and hydration, because generally with gastrointestinal type of illnesses, especially with diarrhea and vomiting, the risk is that dehydration.
Right.
So if it's caught early and treated, it is something that certainly people can get over.
And it's not like this is new. I mean, this has been around for a long time. It's just the number of cases are very unusual. And I think after Michigan, New York, and then Ohio, in terms of the numbers of cases. So this is very concerning. It's interesting. You mentioned produce. Is kind of the main, I guess, carrier, if you will, for this. This because, I mean, it comes from the ground. I mean, these are, you know, things that come out of the ground. And it's always been a concern that we need to, you know, properly clean produce before consuming it.
Yes. It is important. We think about, okay, because fresh fruits and vegetables, very, very healthy for us. They're
right.
So important as a part of our diet. So don't want to dissuade anyone from consuming those foods. But it is important to wash most everything. I think a lot sometimes people think about melons as having that, you know, hard outer shell. We don't consume the outside of the melon, but you want to make sure that you want to wash the exterior of especially any hard skinned fruits, you know, using that vegetable, a clean vegetable brush and doing a little scrubbing and cleaning everything we eat under, you know, running water. And again, using a vegetable brush when we can. And for certain things, and one of the previous outbreaks of this particular, infection have been linked with herbs. So especially thinking about herbs and rinsing, those are leafy things that can, mm-hmm. House bacteria.
Yeah.
And so washing those, and also, fresh berries, those kinds of things that are out there, that things that have a lot of surface area, because that's where, you know, those things kind of things can grow. Making sure that when you're selecting fresh fruits and vegetables, select things that are intact, not bruised or damaged, or with, skin that's been, damaged. You want to minimize that exposure of that interior part of the fruit or vegetable that we're consuming. When we can, of course, you know, try and, when you're cooking does kill the cyclospora. So, you know, things that have been cooked properly are not usually a concern. It's those things that we're consuming fresh.
Yeah.
So it, again, things to think about is making sure that we're washing things when you're shopping at the farm, you know, shopping in a farmer's market or local market, making sure that you're, you know, cleaning things. And if you use like reusable market bags, you know, washing those on occasion, they're very great for the environment. If you want to make sure that the, you know, those kind of things, get, you know, surface areas and things like cutting boards and knives get washed and cleaned on a regular basis.
Yeah. So a lot of those things are, you know, stuff like washing the reusable grocery bags. That's one of those things you don't even think about. You know, you take them to the store, you bring home your groceries, you toss them back in the car, and that's the last you think about them until the next time you go out.
Yeah. So, another, of course, simple things is, you know, not just related to cyclosporiasis, but separating, you know, raw fruits and vegetables from raw meats. This time of year, we're cooking out and doing things like that. So we're taking meat out to the grill. We're preparing salads, making sure to separate those surface areas, separate the utensils, and don't, you know, don't mix those kinds of things that are intended to be cooked and things that we consumed raw.
Yeah. How many times have we talked about cross-contamination? And yes, while we're at it, and while we're at it, because we're coming up on a week where we're going to have another series of 90 degree plus temperatures. And we were talking about this, I think in the past, that when the temperature gets so high, we talk about the importance of not leaving foods out, and we talk about the 2-hour window that goes down the higher the temperature goes up.
Yes. So you want to make sure that if you are having picnics, planting foods outside, you want to decrease the amount of time things sit out to down to like more like an hour or less.
Yeah.
And of course, you can utilize ways to keep foods cold while you're serving them. There are things you can have, if you have some kind of a potato salad or something like that, you can set that pan in a bin of ice to kind of keep it chilled during service time to minimize that. And of course, getting foods out to serve them, then putting them back in the refrigerator so they're not sitting out for those long periods of time.
All very important things to remember, especially, again, we mentioned the cyclosporiasis outbreak, but just food safety in general, especially in the summertime when we're eating out more often, out of door, eating out meaning out of doors more often. Hey, you mentioned real quickly, you mentioned the farmer's market. I know the OSU Extension very involved with the farmer's market and getting more people out there to get fresh foods.
We have, the Power of Produce is a program that we've been specifically involved with at the market for the last several years, where kids and families can sign up and children between the ages of 4 and 15 can get tokens to spend on fresh fruits and vegetables at the market. This year, Blanchard Valley Health System has been the sponsor of this, helping to fund those tokens, and their ambassadors volunteer every week to help distribute those tokens. Our booth, we kind of have interactive, fun activities for families and kids to do at the market in conjunction with that Power of Produce. Right now, we have over 500 youth signed up to participate on this, and last weekend, we had the cucumber crunch, so we celebrated cucumbers, and we handed out samples of 3 different kinds of cucumbers, and I was amazed at how many kids came and tried the cucumbers, ate them, and and they didn't even have to have ranch dressing to coax them to try them. They were loving them. This year, we also want to mention, thank Renewal by Anderson of Northwest Ohio. They've also stepped in to help sponsor this, because when you have so many kids signing up, the cost of this program does go up.
Yeah.
So it was great to have an additional sponsor step in so that we can continue to offer this Power of Produce thing on a weekly basis. Mm. One thing I did want to mention, speaking of the heat, is I did hear from the leadership of the farmers market just this morning that because July 16th is the high summer harvest, so lots of produce is now being harvested and available at the farmers market, but because of the heat, they are going to seek an indoor location this week. So stay tuned. If you get farmers market notifications on your phone, you'll be notified. But okay. Otherwise, check into their website and their Facebook page about where that location might be. We've had it before important. Inside Marathon Center, yeah. But we're not sure if that's going to work out this week or not. But
okay.
Stay tuned for that.
All right. Very important. And again, don't want to dissuade people from having fresh fruits and vegetables, but you want to make sure that you take the proper precautions. And again, Jennifer Little with the Hancock County OSU Extension with us this morning. Jennifer, thanks very much for the update. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Chris. Thanks for having me.
And that will finish up our podcast for today. I want to thank all of our guests for joining us on the program this morning. Remember, you can get more information about all of the topics that we talk about each and every day on the show at our webpage, and that is goodmornings.net. Got a really big show for you tomorrow. Big Boy returns to Fostoria, plus a late amendment to the federal highway funding bill could potentially authorize even heavier trucks on American highways, up to 91,000 pounds or 5 tons more cargo than today's big rigs, a provision that's raising concerns about safety as well as the impact on roads and bridges. And Senator John Husted will join us to share his thoughts on the sudden passing of Senator Lindsey Graham over the weekend. So until tomorrow morning, that is Good Mornings for this morning. Now that you've had a good morning, go on out and make it a good day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.